Fifth Court of Appeals District. In the first cause, the court has allotted 20 minutes for petitioners, respondents have 25 minutes, and amicus curiae 5 minutes for argument. And the court has allotted 20 minutes per side in the last two arguments. The court will take a brief recess between the arguments, and we expect to complete all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is ready to hear argument in 041118, City of San Antonio versus Pollock.
May it please the court, Ms. Calloway will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In the limited time it has this morning, the city would like to focus on two issues that are of primary concern to this state's jurisprudence. The first being the Court of Appeals' unprecedented holding that a person may receive compensation under the Takings Clause for personal injuries. The second issue is the Court of Appeals' decision that an expert's opinion that benzene causes acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which on the face of the record is conclusory and speculative, nonetheless supports the judgment because it is some evidence.
Why isn't this a constitutional takings claim?
Why isn't this a constitutional?
Why isn't it?
Because if you start with the words of the Constitution, which we must, those words only refer to property. And in addition, it is unconceivable in our government that there would be a provision where the state or sovereign can take a person, can take a human being, because that is the requisite for taking under the clause. Property must be taken for public use. So that would mean if this provision, the takings clause, is interpreted to mean that you can compensate someone for personal injuries, that means the state can take a person. And that's totally contrary to our jurisprudence, to the language of the clause. And Gotcher v. State makes reference to this. You have to keep in mind that
isn't there an issue of waiver, though, on the claim here that the state waived, or the city waived its
There can be no issue of waiver on the takings clause. That issue of waiver goes to whether the state pled sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act. But under the takings clause, the burden is very, very clearly on plaintiff. If you wish to be compensated under the takings clause, you must come forward and prove up a takings clause. No matter what your cause of action is, you must go through the takings clause. So there's no issue of waiver. The city had no burden here. The burden is on the plaintiff to prove up its case as a taking.
What's the difference between lymphoblastic and lymphocytic leukemia? Both terms are used.
I have no idea, Your Honor. I know we have traditionally referred to it throughout the record as ALL, and I don't know the difference. Perhaps Mr. Lang does, but I'm sorry, I do not. And returning to this notion of taking a person, where that comes from is you have to keep in mind that the takings clause is a limitation. It's not a cause of action.
You concede they could sue for the lost value of their home in nuisance if they prove that it was intentional public use.
Yes. Yes. This argument goes only to the $7.5 million in personal injury damages. And we do have a separate argument that they haven't gone through the takings clause and proved up the takings clause, proved an affirmative act. And that raises a question. Jennings made very clear what intentional means, but the question that remains after Jennings is failure to act. And this case has really been pled as you should have replaced that system before 1998. is what the case was all about, and you were negligent in your repair of it.
So any cause of action that's brought as a takings claim, maybe it's bring your takings. You took my property, so it's DTPA and it's conversion and it's anything else you can dream up. The fact that the common law for hundreds of years has said, well, you get this damage and emotional anguish and attorney's fees. If it's takings, the rule has been all along, though apparently we've missed it a few times, that you get the property damage but none of the rest of it.
That's correct. And I don't think
we have never said that.
Well, I don't think the court...
In fact, in the old railroad cases, we did the opposite.
Well, in the old railroad cases, if you look at those cases, they're very often... And that's the problem with what the Court of Appeals relies on and what the polyps cite. If you look at those cases, they date back to the late 1800s and the early 1900s. There's no mention in those cases of the takings clause, and the reason there's no mention of the takings clause in those cases is that in that time
because
period...
Because it was railroads,
right,
and railroads
exactly,
just had
were it was proprietary. Anytime, that notion in our jurisprudence is fairly late coming. It's the 30s before you start seeing a discussion of when a city acts, it acts in its governmental function. It's not until 1987 that the Tort Claims Act delineates all these various functions as governmental functions. And so if you go back to that Daniel case that they rely on, which is a railroad case, you will see that there's no mention of the takings clause, there's no immunity, because it's a proprietary function. And in fact, all the cases that the polyps rely on and that the Court of Appeals in turn relied on are all common law nuisance cases. They're either private entities, like the Vestal case, or they are what we were just discussing. They are situations where the government was acting in its proprietary function. When you act in your proprietary function, you can be sued like a private individual. So those cases are all private entity cases, and as such, there's no discussion of immunity, and they also have absolutely no legal relevance.
You've cited cases from other states around the country on this takings issue. Has the U.S. Supreme Court or the Federal Circuits spoken on whether takings can be of a person in the context of the U.S. Constitution?
I do not know about the United States Supreme Court, but there is a case in the Third Circuit, and I'm trying to locate it right now. I will have to give that. It's the Jones. Sorry. It's the Jones versus Philadelphia Police Department, 57 Fed, APPX 939, 3rd, 2nd, 2003. And that's where they say, as I was starting off a few minutes ago, to say the takings clause has to do with eminent domain, which any sovereign has, and it's a limitation on that power. So you start with the notion of that's what's happening in a takings clause. They're saying if you exercise your eminent domain power, we can't do anything about that, but we're going to put a limit on it. We have to compensate people. And in Jones, the court talks about it's just untenable in our way of thinking to think that you can take a person. You can injure a person on behalf of the state, and you simply have to pay for it. That just simply doesn't fit with our jurisprudence.
Well, doesn't Crawford stand for that proposition?
City of Uvalde? No, Your Honor, because there the only damage was, and if you look at the case, it says the measure of damages was for vet bills and for the reasonable market value of lost dogs. And there you had a situation where the city caused some flooding on the plaintiff's land. Sewage went onto the land. The dogs drank the water on the land, became sick, and some of them died.
So
and that is personal property. That's not a personal injury. That is personal property.
I think Justice O'Neill was referring to the city of Fort Worth, where there were injuries, compensation allowed to an injured child.
That was, as I recall, that again has no discussion of the takings clause. It simply is a where the city acts in a proprietary function. And it therefore becomes a common law nuisance case. And that's been the problem all along in this case, is the polyps have assumed if they prove up a common law nuisance case, they have also established a takings claim, that they don't have to worry about the takings clause or any of the interpretations to it. All they have to say is show is we prove common law nuisance, and common law nuisance does not equal a taking. You've got to go through this takings clause. The only cases that they cite that have anything to do with the takings clause are the city of Uvalde versus Crow. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did misunderstand there. And that, as I explained, was personal property, nothing to do with personal injury. In the Gainesville case, which again is only property damage and speaks only of property damage, so neither one can support that. And now if I might turn to the second issue that we'd like to focus on this morning, and that is the causation issue. The Court of Appeals held that there was some evidence of causation, and that was despite the fact that both the experts' opinions on the face of the record, you didn't have to go beneath the record, you didn't have to question scientific reliability or methodology, just on the face of the record, they were conclusory and speculative. And it's long been the law in this state that in a medical causation of a disease case, you've got to prove an exposure rate. You've got to prove an exposure rate that causes the disease. It is not enough for one person or even two persons to come in and sit on a stand and say benzene causes ALL.
Well, 702 says, you know, they've got to give their opinion and the reasons, but not the underlying data unless you object and cross-examine them. You didn't object. And so why isn't this enough in the absence of an objection?
We didn't object to the admissibility. We did preserve a no-evidence challenge. And this court in Coastal Transport Forces versus Crown Petroleum made clear that there is a line between a pure no-evidence challenge, and that's what our challenge was from the very beginning in the JNOV and in our motion to modify judgment. It was very clearly no evidence of causation that the opinions were speculative.
Do that a lot later. So if that's the rule, the fact of the matter is Rule 702 of evidence is wrong. In every case, you have to give your opinion, state the reasons, and introduce the epidemiology studies, the relative risk, and everything. Even if there's no objection at all, the plaintiff just has to do that.
But, Your Honor, we are not arguing that this violates 702. That's the difference.
But the deal is, we're going to say no evidence later. And so really what we need to do is we're just wasting time on 702. We just need a firm rule after Havner that says you got to do everything Havner says, plaintiffs in every case, period.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. In this state, we've always been able to bring up no evidence after the admission of testimony. No question about that. And what I think Coastal did is draw a distinct line.
The whole point of 702 was so you know you didn't have to have the hypothetical question that had every fact in the case. You know, assume this, well, do you have an opinion? Yes. What is it? Okay, we're not going to do that anymore. Just ask them, you have an opinion, what is it? And they say it, and then if somebody wants to hash it out, you can do that on cross-exam, et cetera. But in fact, you have to have all of that stuff in every case or it's no evidence.
Well, you do in a causation analysis. I don't think that there's a conflict between 702 and your basic no evidence analysis of a causation. And Havner is, you know, the benchmark for how do you prove causation. And proving causation is entirely separate from a Daubert-type challenge. And that is all the city waived, was a Daubert-type challenge to the scientific reliability. The city is not trying to go in and say the science is wrong or criticize the studies. The city says take the studies on their face. And on their face, they don't say that benzene causes ALL. They don't say their exposure rate is 200 to 500 times that the experts testify to. And what happened was the causation expert failed to make the distinction between the parts per million stated in the studies and the parts per billion stated in his own experts, the other expert that did the exposure rate. And I don't see any conflict between 702 and a causation is always going to be a separate analysis. From back, as Coastal says, from back in Roan and the Dallas case, going back to the 30s, we've always said an expert, and that's predating Rule 702, we've always said that an expert can't support, his opinion cannot support a judgment if it's a bare conclusion. There's got to be some support for it. And when you have no support, And what Coastal said is if you want the court to act in its gatekeeper function, if you want it to look at the methodology, if you want it to go into the science in a Daubert-type analysis, then you've got to object. But the notion, you know, Habner says, if you've got non-probative evidence, a bare conclusion, does your failure to object to its admissibility transform it into probative evidence? No. And we've said that over and over. The Volkswagen case repeats that, it's a concept that goes way back.
Well, in Volkswagen versus Ramirez, if I may interject here, the expert there had no studies to rely on and had no evidence. No facts, I should say, no studies taken, no concrete physical evidence at the accident site. And we looked at that and said that's the expert's opinion without any of that support is conclusory on its face. In this case, you go into some detail in analyzing the studies that the expert, Dr. Patel, purportedly relied on. You're right. In Coastal Transport, we drew a line between no evidence and scientific methodological analysis. I'm not sure how bright that line is. How bright do you see it, and how do you distinguish Ramirez from your case here where you do have to go into studies and read them and analyze them?
My time has expired, but I have to respond to the court's question.
Yes, you may.
The difference here is, and I think the line in Coastal is. The line in Coastal is that you may not go into the science, you may not talk about scientific reliability. What you have to do is you are limited to the face of the record. I can't criticize the methodology, and that's not what we're doing here. There has to be some support. Here, there happen to be studies introduced into evidence, therefore they're in the record. And when you look at those studies, take them totally as true. I am not quibbling with that. The exposure rate starts stated in terms of parts per million and will not support the opinion in parts per billion. It's 200 to 500 times more, so you don't have that support there. Moreover, none of the studies say benzene causes ALL in vitro or otherwise. And that's not quibbling with the studies. That's not quibbling with the methodology. That's saying, here's the support, look on the face of the record, and it does not support. So you have a subjective opinion.
Thank you, Ms. Calloway. The court will now hear from the amicus, State of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Moss will present argument on behalf of the amicus curiae, State of Texas.
May it please the court. This case should be decided on jurisdictional grounds. Whether the plaintiff's claims fall within the waiver of immunity created by Article 1, Section 17, or the waiver created by the Tort Claims Act, is the threshold question of law, and that question cannot be waived. I'd like to focus on the two things that make Article 1, Section 17 claims different from every other claim against a governmental defendant: the intent requirement and the measure of damages. Those two elements stem from the eminent domain doctrine. Article 1, Section 17 recognizes the existence of the inherent sovereign authority of eminent domain, which is the ability to act inconsistently with private property rights by taking, damaging, or destroying property. But it places a limit on that power by saying that you have to pay compensation or obtain permission. By including personal injury damages in an Article 1, Section 17 recovery, the Court of Appeals has effectively extended the power of eminent domain to include personal injury. And that cannot be the underlying law of Article 1, Section 17. I'd like to briefly address your question, Justice Brisker. Those railroad cases, Hall, I think, is the best example, include private entities exercising delegated eminent domain authority. Therefore, for any tort that isn't within the scope of their delegated statutory eminent domain authority, they have no immunity because they're not conferred immunity by the grant of eminent domain. They're only granted the power to be free of a tort lawsuit for everything they do in the eminent domain power.
So you can bring nuisance, personal injury damages against pipelines,
absolutely,
telephone companies, everybody else, even though it's eminent domain.
Because, and that depends on whether it falls within the category of eminent domain or outside of it, because the common law, as it would apply otherwise, applies to every tort that isn't within the eminent domain power.
Could you, if it's an intentional nuisance, could the city be sued for the property damage value for creating an intentional nuisance?
If there is evidence of a decision made by the city that it knows the property damage is substantially likely to result from its acts, and it decides to act notwithstanding that knowledge.
We've got to put a toxic waste dump somewhere. We're putting it here. It's going to take all y'all's property values down. Then you can recover.
As long as the city is subjectively aware at the time it makes the decision that the damage is going to occur, that's exactly right. But in this case,
not personal injury.
Never personal injury. And that stems both from the text of Article 1, Section 17, and the nature of the eminent domain power, each of which address property. As for Crawford, Justice.
Are there similar cases from the U.S. Supreme Court or federal circuits on the Fifth Amendment taking?
Well, the Fifth Amendment takings clause is a little bit different from ours because it only addresses the taking rather than the damage or destruction of property. And we know that that only occurred. The United States Supreme Court has held that you have to have a possessory taking of property. The addition of the words damage or destruction to the Texas Constitution extend the scope of the consequential damages of a taking to non-possessory and merely trespassory damages in addition to permanent takings of property. So you can't really reach the same issue under the federal constitution because it's written differently.
Does Section 17 specify the type of damages that are recoverable? Isn't the statute vague as to that? It says any damages?
It does not say any damages. It says that property cannot be taken, damaged, or destroyed without compensation being paid therefor or without the landowner's permission. In either case, that would negate the obligation to pay compensation.
This is adequate compensation, doesn't it?
Yes.
Which is what?
Adequate compensation is sufficient money to put you back in the amount of damage that your property value has gone down by virtue of the state's act, of the government taking authority's actions.
So, make sure I got this. So, you could bring a claim, you've damaged the value of my property, just as a taking claim without nuisance at all.
Absolutely.
So, in fact, you don't have a nuisance claim against the government.
That's exactly right. Article 1, Section 17 is
so
not...
So we need to change Tyler versus Lights. We were all wrong. In fact, there is no reason to have a nuisance action against the government. All you can get is what you would get on a straight-up takings claim.
I'm almost out of time. May I answer?
Yes.
In City of Tyler versus Lights, the court merely recognized the fact that in many cases there will be a recovery for actions that cause a nuisance that also constitute a taking. But in Jennings and Gragg, the court clarified that it isn't the fact that the nuisance has been created by itself that creates the obligation to pay compensation. It's the governmental decision to act inconsistently with private property rights, with the knowledge that it is doing so in order to affect a public purpose, that triggers the obligation to pay compensation. And that's the only thing that can trigger jurisdiction over an Article 1, Section 17 claim.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Lang will present argument from the respondent.
Mr. Lang, how do you get past this eminent domain procedural problem? I mean, how do you get past that here?
I'm sorry,
this eminent domain issue. Eminent domain issue, how do you get past that? I mean, that seems to be very clear. It pertains to property damage. And
yes, Your Honor. Can I answer in just one moment? May it please the court, it's our privilege to appear before you on behalf of the Pollack family and present argument in this important case. The eminent domain argument that the city and the AG brought up is completely contrary to the intent and the precedent underlying Article 1, Section 17.
Well, what is the precedent?
The precedent underlying Article 1, Section 17, as this court said in Jennings, is that if a nuisance arises to the level of a constitutional taking, and you establish a taking within the meaning of the Constitution, the nuisance cause of action is preserved.
But Jennings didn't involve personal injury.
No, it did not, Your Honor. But this court went out of its way in Jennings to eliminate a simple common law nuisance, saying there is no simple common law nuisance exception for governmental immunity. And if you're going to bring a nuisance cause of action, it must arise to the level of a constitutional taking. And the language in Jennings was quite clear. This court specifically referred to two elements of damage, physical discomfort and depreciation value of land, citing to the Court of Appeals opinion in Gotcher. This court said that that cause of action, those elements of damage, they're not for a simple nuisance. They are bottomed on the Constitution of Texas, that no property shall be taken, damaged, or destroyed for public use. This court wasn't alone in doing that. It recognized the opinion in Bragg from the Dallas Court of Appeals that said the exact same thing.
But traditionally, the government needs my house for a freeway. I don't get the value of my house plus my emotional anguish from having to move from the old family home, right?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor, because...
That's because just those attorneys were so silly they should have pled a nuisance?
No, Your Honor, that was a taking of property, and if it's a mere taking and there's no substantial...
So you get more money if the government just makes your property not as pleasant than you do if they actually take the whole thing.
Mere annoyance and discomfiture is in the form of a mental anguish, and this court has said that is a depreciation.
Right, but if it goes past annoyance, and that's just a matter of, you know, whether the jury really thinks this is a really bad thing to do or not.
No, you're
in
not.
In fact, you're going to get more money if it's a nuisance than if they just take the whole thing.
Justice Brister, if the nuisance substantially interferes with the use and enjoyment of property, as in Crawford, as in Town of Jacksonville versus McCracken, where a homeowner's health is injured, this court has recognized that that is a nuisance cause of action, but it must
arise
to the level.
You're telling me what we've done, and I'm asking you. The effect of that is that, in fact, if the government, if you sue in nuisance, you just made my property unpleasant. You can get property damage and, really, up to the statutory caps, as much personal injury, emotional anguish as you want. Whereas if they take the whole house, all you get is the house. That's what you think the law is and should be.
That is what the law is, with the exception of the statutory caps. There are no statutory caps under Article 1, Section 17. It is a waiver of immunity for a constitutional nuisance. And we are squarely within Crawford.
Well, there's a huge fundamental issue here. Article 1, Section 17 says no person's property may be taken, damaged, or destroyed for or applied to public use without adequate compensation being made.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there are exceptions. The government can take, if adequate compensation is made, can damage, destroy, or take property as long as it provides compensation in an eminent domain proceeding. Does the force of your argument mean that, as Ms. Calloway mentioned, that the government can take a person, damage a person, as long as it's for public use and as long as adequate compensation can be made? That would be a pretty startling proposition.
And that's what the government and the city are trying to do, which is to startle this court.
Well, then answer that question.
The answer to that, Your Honor, is no. The language of Article 1, Section 17 on its face initially was to require the government to pay in advance for the taking of property. When the words damaged and destroyed were added, this court recognized that those words were added to provide a remedy for any damage which in such cases the legislature might authorize to inflict. And the nuisance cause of action, if it is a constitutional nuisance with that standard, allows for the recovery of physical discomfort and injury to health. And this court recognized in Gotcher versus Farmersville, City of Houston v. George, that Crawford's rule involved governmental action. The city tries to say it's a proprietary case. It's not. This court three times has interpreted Crawford as a governmental action case and that Crawford's rule of liability is constitutional.
And once as a proprietary case, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And then one time as a proprietary case.
Crawford?
In the Osborne case?
That may be, Your Honor, but the language in Crawford, if I may, says when in the prosecution of a public work, it creates a nuisance or permits it to remain, it is liable for all the injuries that result from a failure on its part to properly exercise the power possessed by it.
But and 2 years later, we thought that was a proprietary case. Then some years later, we may have thought it was a governmental case. So We've been of different minds of that.
And the weight of the authority in 1941, this court recognized it as governmental. In 1972, in City of Houston v. George, it was recognized as governmental. And 2 years ago, when this court said there is no simple nuisance exception, Crawford was recognized as governmental. And that is the precedent of this court.
Crawford doesn't mention, as was pointed out, Article 1, Section 17. In what case have we held and considered in that case Article 1, Section 17 taking claims that under a taking that personal injury is recoverable? What case have we held that specifically as regards a governmental entity?
I believe in Crawford. Crawford did not.
Crawford doesn't mention Article 1, Section 17.
Absolutely true, Your Honor. But this court in
My question was, which case have we considered Article 1, Section 17 takings and held as a governmental entity that personal injury is recoverable?
A
very specific question.
I don't have a citation for you, Your Honor.
But you think there are cases that are all around that proposition that should lead us to that conclusion? Is that your position?
It is, Your Honor. And in Jennings, this court described it as well-settled authority that both physical discomfort and depreciation of value of land are both recoverable in a nuisance action only if the nuisance arises to the level of a constitutional taking. Simple nuisance won't get you there. Justice Brister, we are not trying to say that if the lid is off the box and the waiver occurs, you can bring a DTPA claim or any other claim. We are focusing solely on nuisance, which was clearly recognized in Jennings 2 years ago. I want to also briefly address the public policy of this court in recognizing that Article 1, Section 17 protects the right to peaceful and healthful enjoyment of property. In DePue versus City of Waco, this court wrote, "The Constitution of Texas and the decisions of her courts reveal a zealous regard for the rights of the individual citizen."
Sure, but I mean, you know, nobody but the government can come and just take your whole house. Government's different. They can come and take the whole shebang, and there's no question about it. And you don't get any emotional anguish. You don't get any personal injury. You don't get any inconvenience. You don't get nothing. If we have a rule like this where people are going to say, well, it's just a nuisance and I've got all this emotional anguish, aren't we encouraging the government to do more taking people's houses away?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The nuisance cause of action requires a substantial interference with the use and enjoyment of property. If the government were to make the economic decision early on, we're going to put a landfill here, it's going to be dangerous, we know it, our consultants have told us there's fencing in it, we're going to tell these people, you're going to move and we're going to buy your property. I think the Pollocks would probably have appreciated that instead of being told, it's just methane, it's not dangerous, you can live here.
So when did this become an intentional taking?
This was an intentional taking in the mid-1980s when the city was told clearly by its own experts and its employees, there's benzene in the gas, the benzene is migrating as a superhighway through the utility openings into the home, and it is poisonous, it will cause leukemia, it will cause cancer of the lymphopoietic systems. And from 1987 through 1998, the city's gas collection system was completely ineffective. The leachate wells were filled up.
But the intentional act is that they did nothing.
No, sir, Your Honor. Let me answer that. The intentional act is twofold. In our pleadings, we clearly said they permitted, caused, allowed, and maintained actions. We also pled failures. There's no question we pled both. If an intentional failure arises to a conscious decision, that is an action. And the Court of Appeals described it that way. But consistent with Jennings and Gragg and City of Keller, it takes knowing conduct, actions. In this case, all of the evidence is equally probative of actions. The city continued to maintain and use the same leachate collection wells that were filled, the same gas collection tubes and pipes that didn't work, and they continued to do this for 5 years. In 1989, October 18, 1989, there's a memo. The West Avenue landfill and methane leche recovery systems at this landfill are in need of major repair and maintenance. In December of 1994...
Right, so your argument is the intentional, when they decided not to come fix it right, they intentionally took the property again.
It's more, the answer to that is yes, Your Honor, but also when they continued to use the same system, knowing that it was substantially invading the Pollock's property.
The system was already there. The landfill was already there. The methane was already coming. It's nothing, your claim is nothing more than they, when they didn't fix it, that was the intentional act.
No, Your Honor, it's the continued use of it, the continued use of the same systems.
They weren't putting more stuff in the landfill.
Actually, that's true, but they were changing the pipes. They were changing the leche collection wells. And the city's witnesses...
So they were trying to fix it.
The city's witnesses testified that this happened in the absence of negligence. This is just like the Robinson case that was cited in Jennings. If the city is on notice that what they're... The Robinson case from Arkansas. If the city is on notice that what they are doing is causing a substantial invasion, at that point, and it's causing harm, their liability attaches. And we fall so squarely within Jennings and Robinson that, frankly, I'm shocked at some of the arguments that the city is making.
Well, let's talk about experts in Robinson now. As I understand it, there was some testing all around the Pollock's property, but the Pollock's property itself, the realty nor the house were actually tested for the presence of benzene. Is that correct?
The Pollock's property was tested for landfill gas on three occasions. Each time they tested for landfill gas, they found landfill gas. The city did not test the organic content of the gas at the Pollock property, although their experts, the Texas Department of Health, the TNRCC, all told them to do it.
So there was no test that determined benzene, the presence of benzene on the Pollock's property or in their house?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
But there were tests that determined there was landfill gas on the Pollock's property or something?
Three times.
So testing determined there was benzene in certain amounts. I'm sure you're going to address the contention that the amounts were 200 times different depending on, based on the study of the treatise that you're relying on. I guess it was a study. But there was testing that determined benzene around the Pollock's property?
There are two times in the 20-year history that the city actually tested the content of the gas. There was a water sample in a water well about 50 feet from the Pollock's backyard and found very high levels of benzene. In fact, there were several water well tests in the early 80s.
Are those monitoring wells or are those wells drinking water wells?
They were monitoring wells for the Edwards Aquifer in the Austin Chalk right there in that area. And they were test wells that both the Edwards required and the local water authority. Justice Wainwright, the other time the gas was tested for organic content was in 1998 after an entirely new gas collection system was installed. And that new gas collection system was also ineffective completely of stopping the migration of gas. And what they did is they tested the gas at GMP9, which is a gas monitoring probe about 50 feet from the Pollock's backyard, and it found the content of benzene. Dan Kraft, our landfill engineer, used an EPA landfill model. He didn't make it up. He used 10,000 pages of the city's own records and computed that the level of benzene in the gas was 160 parts per billion.
But in Exxon Corp. versus Bukowski, court says ALL, most common form of leukemia in children, that the experts are all agreed, we don't know what causes it in the vast majority of cases. Since I wrote it, let's assume for the sake of argument is correct. Now, in this case, we've got a jury conclusion that this ALL was caused by benzene. Now, if a court happens to know that scientists are agreed that there is no scientifically reliable evidence in a case where somebody objected to it and looked at all the studies, there's no scientifically reliable evidence tying benzene to ALL in children, because there's no argument here, we approve case finding, because there was no Robinson objection. In this case, we're going to prove exactly that. over a no evidence challenge. Isn't that problematic?
No, Your Honor, and I agree that on the record in Makovsky, the decision is absolutely correct.
In great answer.
In Makovsky, there was an objection, repeated objections to reliability. Here we have none. In Makovsky, the exposure medium and the studies relied on were totally different. The exposure involved children and adults drinking water. And in that case, the studies were completed.
So instead of benzene in the soil outside their house, they were drinking it in Makovsky.
No,
and that wasn't enough, but it's okay here to overcome a no-evidence challenge.
Correct, Your Honor. In Makovsky, as I recall, there was insufficient evidence of exposure. And the link between benzene and ALL was not shown in the record on that case. Our case is totally different. It involves an in utero exposure of a fetus in the first trimester. Dr. Patel explained that in utero exposure in the first trimester is particularly damaging to the developing DNA of the fetus. And he explained how during organogenesis, the development of the organs, the fetus is particularly susceptible to the DNA mutations. He also explained, Justice Wainwright, in terms of the dose, that cumulative and chronic exposure to the fetus in the first trimester is totally different and more excessive than a single peak hit. In the studies involving workers exposed to benzene, a single peak hit of 31 ppm is definitely more than a single peak hit of 160 ppb. But the city has completely mischaracterized Sarah's exposure. The 160 ppb was daily, chronic, weekly, chronic, and cumulative in the first trimester. Her exposure was way more than 200 times that of an adult worker. And in fact, the fetus was 3 ounces in the first trimester versus a 150-pound adult. Dr. Patel also...
Is it true that the studies do not show that chronic exposure at a level, say, 160 ppb, at some point amounts to an exposure of 31 ppm or more?
Justice Heck, the studies do not say that exactly, but language from Plaintiff's Exhibit 159 says the following. Cumulative exposure to benzene correlated to increased mutation frequency and leukemia risk. And the Zhang study, Exhibit 159 on the last page, has several sentences that make clear that the leukemia risk is greatly increased for an in utero transfer. And it isn't just limited to AML. And if you look at the footnotes in that article, it actually refers to ALL and leukemia in the aggregate. In Makovsky, the record was such that they didn't prove the association. In here, I'm just going to read a few excerpts from those studies. Chromosome-specific aneuploidy plays a key role in benzene-induced leukemia. Benzene has a clear dose-dependent effect on the aneuploidy of chromosome 9, causing direct genetic damage in the fetus following maternal exposure. Key changes related to the development of child leukemia, which occur before birth. Dr. Patel did not make this up, and his studies clearly established the link that, first of all, benzene is tetragenic on the fetus.
But I'm very interested in all this. Let's assuming that your arguments are very good. Let's assume you don't prevail on this. What would be the result to other people that live like your client did, or exposed not maybe to benzene, but some other cancer-causing agents that are in the same situation where there's other concrete scientific evidence that the exposure caused the disease to either manifest in utero or sometime later during life? Does that give the city or these other municipalities a pass on this type of conduct? Or how would
I think it does, Your Honor. In fact, several of the points that the city makes, which is we don't have testing records, therefore you can't prove exposure. The reason we don't have tests inside the house is for 20 years they disregarded what their employees and their experts told them to do. And if on the other hand, with regard to liability, if the intentional failure to act does not create liability, if this court doesn't find that that is in fact an action, then the city is encouraged to do nothing. If they are in the face of knowledge that what they're doing is causing substantial harm, insulating them from an intentional failure to act on these facts, gives them that green light.
Let me ask you about Dr. Patel's opinion. I'm looking at it, his last page, page 5. It says it's his medical opinion. I'm paraphrasing some. There's reasonable medical and scientific certainty linking maternal exposure to benzene, organic acids, and hydrocarbons in the environment with the development of ALL in Sarah Pollock. He lists three causes there. Is that sufficient? Is his opinion sufficient?
In this case, Your Honor, it is, because there was no objection to reliability, methodology, or foundation.
Let's put that question to the side.
Yes, sir.
An expert who says there's three causes for the development of ALL, is that sufficient to establish with reasonable medical and scientific certainty that one of them is the cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
Approximate cause?
When you read his report, which was admitted without objection, along with his testimony at trial, it's very clear that the focus is on benzene and its destruction of the DNA in utero. He explained in detail at trial that it's benzene and its metabolites and what they do to the fetus in the first trimester.
Did he exclude the effect of organic acids and hydrocarbons on the development of ALL?
I think what he said, Your Honor, is that they also contributed. They as well contributed to the mutation of the DNA and the chromosomal damage. And the chromosomal damage is not a mere signature injury in this case, like the situation in Rock in San Antonio. They had no exposure evidence. In this case, we had exposure evidence from Dan Kraft, his report, Les Montgomery, the city's expert, who they didn't bring, but we read his deposition. We also had exposure evidence from the Pollocks, who testified that they smelled the gas in their home, and it was so strong that they had to close the doors. All the experts agreed that that odor was the volatile organic such as benzene. Your Honors, in this case, the only ipsy-dixit testimony, the only bare, unsupported conclusions came from the city's own expert, Dr. Didek, who did no literature search. He cited no studies. He didn't know what a chromosome was at his deposition when I asked him to identify the trisomies. But he was hired with the express purpose to undercut the reality of the documents. He wrote it in his notes at his pre-deposition prep. And that's what the city has done in this entire appeal. They have undercut the reality of this court's precedent. They have undercut the reality of Article 1, Section 17. They have undercut the reality of their own shameful record of the landfill. This case can be affirmed on its merits. This case can be affirmed on the city's waiver. For them to stand before you and say they didn't waive immunity when they didn't plead it, they didn't file special exceptions, they didn't file a plea to the jurisdiction, and they didn't file a motion for summary judgment. For the precedent of this court, we fall squarely within it, and there's no extension of the law at all. That's all we have, Your Honor.
One question, final question. Do you know the difference between lymphoblastic and lymphocytic leukemia?
Well, lymphoblastic and lymphocytic are the same. The difference between AML and ALL is based on the circulating cells. And ALL is circulating lymphocytes as opposed to AML, which is myelogenic cells.
Try to avoid the problem with personal injury damages under the takings clause by saying, well, the cases say, like City of Dallas versus Jennings, the cases use the word discomfort and relies on City of Tyler versus Likes. You go to the City of Tyler versus Likes, first of all, that discussion is in the context, it's really a Tort Claims Act case because the court finds there's no intentional taking, therefore they don't even go into an analysis of taking. So it says nothing about taking. In addition, it cites Restatement Second of Torts 821D, which makes very clear that there is a legal distinction between the interest in being free from interference with your property, either your use and enjoyment of property, and an interest in being free from emotional distress. And what it says is that the former You have a property right to use and enjoy your land. And if someone interferes with that, the nature of damages are in the nature of an annoyance and discomfort. That is a property right. However,
what's the discomfort? The discomfort in moving, the discomfort in packing bags, and discomfort in what? I mean, that's.
I would say the discomfort here, you had subsidence in the backyard, and they, you know, they couldn't go out and enjoy
like
their.
Methane.
Right, they smelled methane. There was a hole in the backyard. That's discomfort, and that is an interference with a property right. It's not an interference with a personal right. And I think the restatement, which likes quotes, makes that distinction very clear. Also, this court and other appellate courts have made clear that the use of the word damaging in the takings clause is to reach just such an interference. It's not just taking the property, it's also interfering with a right. That's a property right like use and enjoyment, and they've recognized a damage element of discomfort and annoyance. And that is not to say, and that's what the finding here was, it was loss of use and enjoyment. And that is interference with a property right. Nuisance itself is interference with a property right, and it's defined in those very terms, interference with the enjoyment and use of land.
Well, can it be a discomfort of seeing your child diagnosed with this disease, discomfort of not being able to see your child go play in a backyard because there's an possible exposure back
there? That is mental anguish, Your Honor. That is a personal injury damage, and the text of the Constitution cannot be expanded, and this court has recognized that in Weber, again in the Bullion case cited in the brief, that you cannot take those words and expand them, no matter how uncomfortable or how questionable the end result may be to the court. The court cannot rewrite the Constitution, and it very clearly, because as the state points out, hooks to eminent domain power, very clearly is also tied to a property concept that will not ever include mental anguish damages or personal injury damages. With regard to...
Under what situation can the city or state be responsible for landfills that contain cancer-causing agents or some other agents that migrate off the property either through air or through some type of underground water contamination and gets people ill?
When there is a waiver of immunity under the Tort Claims Act, that is the cause of action for it.
But there will never be a waiver under the Tort Claims Act. I mean, it's very limited. You'd argue that there is no waiver under the Tort Claims Act.
In this particular case, because they didn't prove up the case and they didn't get a finding in the case of condition of property.
But it would be very difficult to make a Tort Claims Act claim here. And so really the answer to Justice Medina's question is no remedy.
There may be no remedy, but as I said, the court is bound by the notion of sovereign immunity, and there must be an express waiver. And until the court finds an express waiver either under the Takings Clause or under the Tort Claims Act, there is no liability, and that has long been the law of this state. With regard to causation argument, Justice Brister had asked me where you draw the line. I think you draw the line. It's a very clear line. There's a great difference between attacking causation and no evidence and what Havener says about causation and trying to attack what Havener says about statistical significance. We cannot go into the statistical significance part of Havener because we did not object to the scientific reliability. We didn't make a Daubert objection, and we have not tried to do that. Nothing about Daubert changes causation analysis. For hundreds of years in this state, you have had to prove cause and fact, and in a toxic tort case like this, cause and fact means exposure rate. And here you have conclusory and speculative opinions, both as to the exposure rate taken from the bottom of the well. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.